The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Pathfinder finds a path for OT, or does she? Another psycho discussion begins. Mark makes billions of value in hardware for everyone else. Joe gets wise to being a control freak whence he measures. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Management Analytics is hosting a new service offering that anybody with responsibility for cyber should be anxious to embrace. It combines the strengths of four of the top experts in the world to provide a low-cost entry-level research and advisory service that is affordable and informative. Throughout the hour, you will be hearing from the team of experts who have offered their time, expertise, research, and analysis results. Each in their own area, they will provide a live online remote session once a month, so between them you will get a weekly dose of expert analysis, access to a research paper or advisory update, a live online remote session where they will discuss their most recent results, and an opportunity to ask them questions and get their answers. Doug Simmons, from Cognitive Defense, is your trusted cybersecurity and human risk management advisor. As the longtime global vice president of Gartner's, and before that Burton Group's, security and risk management consulting groups, Doug has helped hundreds of organizations develop, assess, and revise their approaches to information protection and improve their cybersecurity posture. Doug's efforts will focus on the emerging field of human risk management, where cognitive attacks are exploited to gain advantages resulting in cyber extortion, high-valued information leaks, financial frauds, large-scale denial of services, and other consequences. Maria Sumnicht, from OT Governance, is your trusted security advisor on operational technology for critical infrastructures and public services. As the lead for cybersecurity in New York City, Maria was tasked with creating the governance structures and deploying them to 67 agencies with hundreds of billions of dollars of operational technology. This ranged from more than $1 billion of new digital parking meters, to traffic control systems, video surveillance systems, water supply systems, and another 63 operational technology environments. Maria's efforts will focus on cyber systems that every company, municipality, and person in Western society depends upon for their day-to-day lives. Keeping the lights on, the water flowing, and the heat and air conditioning working are requirements of modern life, and Maria knows these systems from the inside out, and from the outside in. Mike DeSabato, from Trust Architecture, is your cybersecurity advisor on Trust Architecture, the structures you put in place to assess and make decisions about who and what to trust for what purposes. Mike was a service director and lead analyst at Gartner, and before that Burton Group, where he focused on technical and governance aspects of networking, telecommunications, collaboration, and a range of related areas. Mike's efforts will focus on how entities can understand and manage the trust relationships they have with other entities, their workers, customers, supply chain, systems, and content. Whether you are trying to implement a zero-trust approach to your enterprise, or trying to determine how to manage changes in trustworthiness of your supply chain over time, this is a critical component you will have to be increasingly aware of over time. Fred Cohen, from Trusted Cyber, rounds out the team, with his long career in cybersecurity starting as the father of computer viruses, through today where his trusted advisory services are used worldwide to address the overarching needs to understand and manage cybersecurity programs. Fred's efforts will take a broad view of cyber-related issues, putting them into an overarching structure and helping you understand the cybersecurity brain, the overarching cognitive system that is needed to operate a successful cybersecurity program. In combination, These four service elements provide unique insights into the path forward for your cybersecurity program, and they do so at an entry-level price point that is affordable to anyone seriously engaged in building or running a cybersecurity program. But there's one other critical item that comes with this combined service. Along with your subscription to the overarching service, you also get tickets to the Executive Leadership Network's premier forum offering once per quarter. In this venue, you will meet and enter into substantive discussions with leaders from enterprises of all sorts and sizes, get to know and discuss the issues of the day, and meet many leaders in their fields from around the world. You can sign up for this service starting today by going to thecybershow.co and clicking on the service you are most interested in, or directly through the Cyber Show. We look forward to seeing you and hope you enjoy the show.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Good morning, Maria. How are you doing today?
I am doing swell. How are you today?
Well, as in things are swelling up.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so, Maria, tell us about your company and what you do.
Well, I'm the CEO of OT Governance. We are industrial cybersecurity for executives.
That's a good start. And if you end there, then we can continue the conversation. As you're well aware, you know, on the show, lots of people go immediately into their pitch. And you gave me that half second delay to intervene before pouring us to tears. So, okay, OT, operational technology. To me, you know, information technology is all the bits and bytes that have to do with content and its utility to the company. Operational technology is these cybernetic things, these things where you have sensors, actuators, communications, and control. Mm-hmm. Does that sound like the operational technology we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay, yes. So we're talking about things that move, and typically not little teeny things that move, but big monstrous things that move, things like water systems, right? And
right.
Power right. grid and critical yes. infrastructures, but also manufacturing.
Right. right? Yeah, your General robotics. Processing.
Robotics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't even remember robotics. It wasn't, you know, we all used to be a long time ago. Robotics was my field of interest. It's not that it has waned. It's just that it has transmorphorized, whatever it's into. I don't know what the right word is for the extent.
Transmorphed would be a good word.
Yeah, I think there's an "ized" in there somewhere. I don't know.
Transmorphized.
I'll type transmorphized. It has transmorphized into, or morphed, I think is the thing. You know, I'd say like people that change their shape. They morph.
Yes. All right. Yes.
So, operational technology. All right. Governance. What is governance as opposed to government, as opposed to all the other stuff we do that's not governance?
Well, governance is your policies that are overarching in the protection of those operational technologies. So it would be what you're trying to do is to set up an environment where over time you are on a path to secure and protect your environment.
All right, you're talking about cybersecurity governance. But,
yes.
But in a broader sense, governance is, well, I guess, the thing that governments should be doing.
But they aren't.
I don't think they ever have been, frankly.
That's true.
Politics,
good point.
Politics is not necessarily governance. But so operational technology governance, so making those decisions at the top level about how things should work.
Exactly.
For executives.
Correct.
What does that mean? What's the difference between executives and what they have to do for operational technology governance and everybody else?
Well, executives such as the CEO is without having to use that is the executioner. executes on the on the priorities that the board has, and one of them right now that most boards are focused on is governance, especially in the area of cybersecurity. So executives need to understand their business operations and make sound decisions that doesn't hinder any progress or production, while at the same time getting the policies. So policies are, I equate policies to, a good policy is equivalent to a good piece of legislation. So it is something that you can give to others so they can execute their in within their domain what that policy is trying to cover. To I can't think of a word. It's been a tough morning, Fred.
there are sort of two things that come to my mind, right? That is the things that are prescribed and the things that are proscribed.
Prescribed.
Well, no, proscribed. So the prescribed, the things you must do or should do. Proscribed, the things you may not do. Right?
Right.
So when I think about, especially in cybersecurity, you know, you have all these rules that say you must maintain the confidentiality of confidential information, which seems obvious, but apparently it's not. And then the other one is you must not give other people your password.
Right.
Yeah. So there's the stuff you have to do and the stuff you should not
should
do.
Should not do.
Yep. And that bounds it, right?
Right.
Boundaries on how people do their jobs, but it doesn't hopefully stop them from getting their jobs done. So,
right.
So this is one of the big problems that I see. And I have articles on this. One of them is called Security Load Explode. It's just like, yeah. So it seems to me like we keep adding rules. I almost never see some requirement for cybersecurity where they say, oh, you no longer have to do this. Don't worry about that. Right. That just doesn't happen. Right.
No, they're usually built upon.
Yeah. So there's always more. And the more stuff you pile on me that I have to do that, you know, is an impediment to getting my work done, the less work I can get done and the worse I am at my job. And what that translates into is I don't do my job. In fact, I probably quit or something like that.
Right.
And so, yeah. So, or, but the other thing that happens is people bypass security mechanisms, right? So they, you know, they have, all right, so you cannot use your cell phone to make a phone call when you're at home related to business, which is after hours, you know, but you're trying to get the sale closed or whatever you're trying to do. And they say, no, you can't do that. Well, you know what people do, of course, they use their cell phone.
Right? Yeah.
They make a call on their own phone, on their own time, on their own dime to try and help the company. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is we punish them for it.
Mm-hmm.
So in the operational technology space, what do you do to help these executives make decisions that don't cause people to be unable to get their jobs done?
Well, we find a path for them, and that's reasonable and prudent because, again, you don't want to be a stumbling block to what they're trying to do or what their people are trying to do, or as you said, they'll quit, right? You don't want some sort of dictator at the top telling you got to do it this way. You know, governance is empowers. So from the executive on down, the empowerment to actually execute should be something that is definable at each level, right? So we find that definable path. We find that path that won't put any barriers into their business. You don't want to affect sales or anything like that or manufacturing. So,
of course, OT governance is about the operational technology, not so much about the sales, right?
So
it's about your manufacturing line shuts down, for example.
Right.
Well, a great example recently is because of, you know, some of the strikes or also because of failures in supply chain. People are unable to execute on their operational requirement to manufacture stuff.
Right.
So if you can't make it, you can't ship it, you can't sell it, and the whole thing sort of falls apart. So the classic, you know, resolution to that is to have resiliency or inventory.
Yeah.
Right. And just in time, got rid of inventory as much as possible. but it didn't replace it with resiliency. So right. Now people are talking about resiliency. So, for example, in your efforts to help executives make better decisions, what sort of things do you do in terms of resiliency versus supply chain?
Well, a lot of
just in time and so forth.
Right. In manufacturing, it's all about the supply chain. And in order to be resilient, you can't rely on one manufacturer for, you know, Gadget X. Gadget X, you need to identify that Gadget X is some sort of must have for what you're trying to do. Okay. And if only one vendor produces Gadget X, then that is something that needs to be mitigated in some sort of way. You have to find a way that if that particular manufacturer or supply chain of Gadget X, if it goes under, what are you going to do? Are you going to lose your business? You need to identify things like that. And we help them identify where they're vulnerable and identify a path for them to mitigate that vulnerability. So you don't.
Right. A great example, right? So you have choices, right?
Right.
So one choice might be, well, get a bunch of inventory so I have 6 months supply, which of course costs money now and prices might change. And of course, if it's something like food, it goes bad over right. time. And so there's yeah. limitations. But so it's all that complexity of whether to do that, whether to pay somebody else as a redundant supplier and have it cost more. Mm-hmm. Or whether you can handle the volume, maybe you have to reduce the volume or change the components so that your composite, whatever you make out of the component, doesn't require it, or there's two versions, or so there's lots and lots of ways out. And I guess the point you're trying to make is that, you're trying to find a path. You're trying to identify all the ways out and have the decision maker be aware
right.
of the consequences of their decision and make decisions. You don't force decisions on anybody, do
no.
you?
No. We advise and they take our advice and they can either execute on it or not. But the decision is ultimately theirs. a good example of that is what I did in New York City. And many of these agencies would buy rather sophisticated IoT devices that would manage critical infrastructure, and I'll just use the traffic light controllers for every intersection in the city of New York. That's a lot of them. And they brought in a device, and at first they were saying that we're going to hold them up in their deployment, and they need to put this out there. And we went ahead and not only did we do pen testing on the device, the firmware, the device application management, but we looked holistically end to end at the network too.
All right. Right? So hang on a second. And so pen testing, that's where you test that the pen writes. What is pen testing?
Penetration testing.
Okay. So you try to determine whether you can break in or not, because these, yeah. these abbreviations that, in the field we know, the general yeah, yeah. public listening to the show might say, oh, you're seeing whether your pen writes? What does that have to do with the traffic lights in New York City? But it might have to do with giving tickets to people that run the lights. Then you need pen testing for the officers.
So we would put our black hats on and look at everything possible about that that's right, solution.
So we're going to break for a second here to talk about black hats versus blue, red, white, green, and so forth. I think it's that the use of these colors associated with good and bad are probably discriminatory in their nature, and that we should start talking about hats in a different way. Our hacker hat, which is a good hat, that exploration hat,
yes,
versus our evildoer hat.
Okay.
And so we're going to start. All right, one of our making a new project, start renaming our hats. So okay,
evildoer hat and a good hat.
Critical to the future of cybersecurity, renaming of our hats. Okay.
Okay.
Put that on the list somewhere and see how that. Yeah, what is it? You throw it up against this wall and see what sticks.
Evildoer hat,
Evildoer. Yeah, yeah. What's the name of the
and an angel hat.
Yeah, right. Mini me. Yeah, yeah. Oh, angels versus devils. There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Although, there are, people, we're our show doesn't deal with religious issues, but there are people that, you know, have religions that glorify both angels and devils. So I wouldn't want to discriminate one way or the other. But the other thing, you mentioned when you were the whatever of New York, and, you know, people who haven't listened to the previous interviews we did on the show about you don't know about that. So just give us a very brief 30-second, what did you do at New York?
Well, I was the urban technology architect for the city of New York, responsible for the Internet of Things and the industrial control system solutions, all of them that were being procured by the city for all 67 agencies.
All right. So you were like the ultimate cat herder. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah. Cat and chickens. all in the same coop.
Yeah. Some eat and others get eaten. Okay. Exactly. You're great. All right. Maria, thank you so much.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. War is breaking out all over, and cybernetic systems are now a deeply embedded part of war. And disinformation is a critical part of cyber warfare, as it always has been. That's why we depend on the honest brokers of the public airwaves to help us get the truth. Propaganda. Trust me when I say this is breaking news on the Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5. We know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening.
Hi, I'm Doug Simmons from Cognitive Defense, your trusted cybersecurity and human risk management advisors. As the former global vice president of Gartner's and Burton Group's security and risk management consulting group for many years, I've helped hundreds of organizations develop, assess, and revise their approaches to information protection and improve their cybersecurity posture. My company, Cognitive Defense, is introducing a new research and advisory service available live, online, remote, starting in November. Our service is focused for company executives and senior technologists facing the emerging challenges of human risk management within the realm of cybersecurity, and who are looking for expert advisors to advise them on alternatives they might have missed, anticipate future developments, and help get a handle on the path forward. We help evaluate human cognition of threats, vulnerabilities, and consequences that affect how your organization's data is managed, accessed, and protected. You can join our basic advisory service starting now. It includes a weekly live online remote webinar with a top analyst, 4 short analyst reports per month, tickets to an executive leadership network forum once per quarter, and access to our advisory network. Don't miss this outstanding opportunity for great advice from real human experts that is free of AI-generated BS and full of sound, sensible advice. For full details, look for our link on thecybershow.co or go directly to our website at cogdef.com to sign up. That's cogdef.com. We hope to see you there next month.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now
It's the name of a segment on our show.
It seems that people are listening to the show, and here's another reason I know. In the last week or two, I mentioned this concept of squatting. People have been squatting on domain names for a long time. You know, they change one letter in the domain name or something like that. And people will accidentally make a typo, or they can actually put it in an email and people will mistakenly go to the wrong website and be spoofed. In our case, people have been squatting on email addresses for a similar amount of time. So I was not surprised to find that there was an email from call831200406@gmail.com being sent into some of my other domains. Now, the thing to understand here is that for a long time, I've been using my phone number as a Gmail address. The reason is, if I tried to use Fred, well, guess what? Somebody else used Fred, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And so, you know, by the time you get to a Fred 5792416, nobody can remember who you are. So naturally, I wanted people to be able to remember who I was, but also figured I would use something useful. So what I use is call, period, the first three digits of my phone number, period, the next three digits, period, and then finally the last four, @gmail.com. So the proper email address is call, period, 831, period, 200, period, 4006, @gmail.com. So apparently in the last couple of weeks, somebody who listened to the show and said, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll spoof his email address and see whether that works. Now, unfortunately, I didn't get to enjoy this. I have no idea what was actually sent because Google intervened. Google figured out that this was some sort of a nefarious message, or I don't know what was in the message, obviously. But they decided to notify that somebody was trying to spoof my domain by using this other email address. So I never even got the email that they were trying to send in. And of course, you know, in my case, it's a little bit disappointing. I'd really like to, you know, find out what they sent me. So what would I do? You know, so what I did was I sent an email back once I knew that they had tried it. So my email is from call.925.454.0171@gmail.com, which is another one of my old phone numbers. And it was sent to call831200406@gmail.com. And I said, that's the subject was, your ploy is unlikely to work. And the content I wrote was, it got caught by Google before it even hit any of our emails. However, I thought you should know that even if it got through, I pretty much know what I sent and therefore am unlikely to be tricked by it. Of course, you can feel free to send whatever you like to whoever you like, but be careful not to slander, libel, or otherwise defame. It's not polite, and of course, it could be met with a legal action. And I signed it my usual way. Now, I haven't heard back, but I'm appealing to those of you out in Radio Land, if you know who did it, have them email me back, and using their some other email address, not the one that won't get through, and let me know who you are, and, you know, look, I appreciate a good game, no problem, but I would love to know what message you sent that got you caught, because, you know, it's always interesting to learn more about how the world works. In the meanwhile, let's see how it goes. One of the newest frauds on the internet today is a multi-step process. It starts with an initial contact offering something you want or need for your job. Then as you start to communicate, you get a link or a file emailed to you, chatted to you, texted to you, or connected to you through a social media application. When you open this file or click on the link, it displays a message indicating that it was corrupted and could not be opened. But in reality, it contains malicious code that merely displays that message and leaves a Trojan horse on your computer. Once that Trojan horse is in place, the attacker is in your system and expands their access to perform any of a number of malicious acts, typically ranging from extortion, this is often in the form of ransomware, to financial theft, for example, by altering banking information on an invoice. What can you do about it? Well, there's nothing much you can really do to prevent this sort of deception from working. The reason is that if you don't use the internet to get in touch with people in order to get your job done, you're likely not to be able to get the job done. But when you encounter the situation, you can recognize this scenario. And if you do, you can immediately contact whoever's in charge of cybersecurity and have them fix the problem before it gets worse. In the meanwhile, try and be safe out there, but don't imagine you're going to be perfect against modern threats. This segment is called, How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it. How do they do that? How do you do email spoofing? Well, actually, it's pretty easy. For a Gmail address, you go to Gmail and you ask for a new Gmail address and you type in the address that you want. And if it's available, you get it. So in this case, they just took an existing email address, got rid of the periods, and asked for it and got it. And then, of course, once they have it, that's their email address, so they can send email to whoever they want, and they tried sending it to me. They may lose the address if Google decides that, you know, somehow that's not reasonable or fair or whatever, but I'm not going to go try and pester Google about such things. In any case, any CEO in the world that wants to spoof one of their email addresses, just go to Gmail and type in another email address that's very similar and see if people notice the difference. It should be fine. But be careful. When you try to fool your workers to see if they're susceptible to spoofing, they may feel as if you are trying to catch them being bad. Those bad feelings may lead to more problems than they solve. If you really want to get a handle on this sort of thing, you should get in touch with the folks at Cognitive Defense. They can help you build a better approach to preventing harm. And that's how you do that.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, ELN, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence, and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel to exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events and help host online forums, panels, and events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. For more details, become a member at enterprisemindset.com.
ELN will have a forum at the Monterey Plaza Hotel on November 13th and 14th of this year. To sign up, go to thecybershow.co and click on the link to ELN. Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. Mark Menz was one of the early folks in digital forensics, working for law enforcement and for the public well-being, as well as on many private cases. Early in my forensics career, I encountered Mark, and I thought you'd be interested in some of the things that we've done throughout the course of our lives and some of the discussions we've had. Here's Mark.
All right, we're back with Mark Menz, and you know, the only one of the only three people that ever read my paper on floppy disk electromagnetic loss forensics, and who has a copy of every system he's ever had, the hardware and all the software, to be able to reconstruct it for his forensic purposes. So this started in high school. All right, so then what happened?
So my first forensic case, I had a insurance agent come to me. And we were talking about something unrelated to the case. Oh, and the insurance agent said, hey, you know, by the way, you do a lot of computer stuff. I have this guy making a claim that he lost all his computer programs when a baseball came through the front window of the house, hit the floppy disks, and knocked them off the desk onto the floor.
Just for clarity, it's true that magnetic media, if you hit it with an impulse, can actually lose some of its memory, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
But not a baseball.
not a baseball and not a stack of floppy disks. Okay.
Right. So they fall on the floor. They all got erased. And so he's claiming a $5,000 claim. And this is a 1978, 79 timeframe. I happen to have the exact model computer that the disks were on, which were 8-inch floppies off a TRS-80 Model 2.
Sure.
So we went and we looked at the floppy disks, and they were absolutely blank. They had been formatted.
Ah, so this was not a baseball. Baseballs don't reformat them, really.
Correct. So it doesn't know if, you know, baseball doesn't know a file from a bit, so... we told them that no, these were formatted. The baseball did not do this, and had to write up a little report. And he denied the claim.
So did you get paid for that? And was it a percentage of the claim?
That's where I learned my second biggest lesson in life. Never give the
paperwork first.
That's right. The check first and then the report. So no, we didn't charge for that. But it was a good laugh, and he wound up buying us pizza and beer. So,
So pizza and beer, that's, pretty good pay. At that point in 86, you're what, 12 years old or something like that?
I wish I could say I was 12 years old, but I wasn't. So,
I'm not just saying.
And
at least you still have your white hair.
That's true. That's true. That's a good point.
It's so all right. So that's your first forensics case. Love it. And what's the first case you got paid for? So did you then get into forensics at that point, or was there something else?
No. Well, we started. I got together with some friends I had from the TRS-80 club and from high school. And we wound up designing and selling the first aftermarket floppy controller for the IBM PC.
Cool. And now, did you design that, or how did you do that?
I helped the design. There was three of us that did the design work, so I only did a really small portion of it.
Did you patent it?
Well, no, because it was already
You were infringing their patents.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, they didn't have a patent on it, but and we also designed one for the TRS-80 Model 3. So we had an aftermarket floppy controller for the TRS-80 Model 3 that we wound up selling to just about every Radio Shack franchise store. And
so you became multi-millionaires at that point in time, right?
I wish. No.
All multi-thousandaires.
Thousandaires. You know, we were able to live. Then we did the IBM controller, floppy controller. Then we did the first combination floppy controller and hard drive controller for the PC.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And then we sold that to this young upstart in Texas, as far as we sold controllers to him, with a company called PC Limited, which became...
Oh, you're asking me. Do I remember anything from that era?
So, Michael Dell.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so you sold the hardware to Dell that he started his business.
The first hard drive controllers. Yep, and I still have the receipts and everything. And he met him down at Comdex, which was a computer show that was in Las Vegas every year.
Sure. Now, just checking on this, you didn't get any equity in Dell at that point and then become a billionaire, right?
Right.
You should have taken equity instead of selling it to him, but I guess life's tough, right?
Yeah, hindsight's always 20/20, right? So
actually, my hindsight's more like 20/30 now. But
made hard drive controllers. We went on to do a number of products for that company. It was called Micro Mainframe, and we wound up doing that, and then that market got really kind of squirrely with big players. So we started doing
highly competitive, when you say not squirrely. I mean, it was legitimate market, right?
Oh yeah, legitimate market, just we were too small. So then we started doing video products. And I had another high school friend who is a genius when it comes to video. And we brought him in the company. We did a overlay card for Apple that overlaid video on computer video on NTSC video.
Oh,
we did a digitizer for the Apple. We did the premium overlay device for the Amiga, so you could use the Amiga in a broadcast environment called product called SuperGen. But we also did an overlay card for the PC called Video Charlie. And it would overlay PC graphics on NTSC video.
Yeah, so you could just attach any TV.
Any video signal. So, like, you could feed a video signal into your EGA card. It would overlay EGA graphics on that signal, and then you could put it back out and record it or broadcast it, which is what happened. One of our customers was a company called the Financial News Network. I worked with two guys.
Yet another opportunity to become a billionaire, unrealized, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That was my second flaw. And so when you see that little ticker tape at the bottom, I was responsible for getting the everything's coordinated so the video would work, and they had the ticker tape at the bottom.
I love it.
You know, I think a lot about this, right? You know, in all of our stories and careers, you know, it's like when you're walking downtown Toronto, for example, this happened to me a couple times, but you know, you're with somebody you haven't, you know, just met or whatnot, and making small talk, and they say, you know, my great grandfather used to own, you know, this, you know, 17 blocks, and if we still had it, it'd be worth $18 billion. It's like, yeah, that, you know, that's a thing. You know, living our careers, we've seen a lot of this. It's like you know, but how do you know what's worth what at the time? And if your great grandfather sold that, you know, and bought food and so forth, then that was probably the better option. But on the forensic side of it, right? This is again one of the things I love about insecurity, you get to push that extreme, right? You know, with Mark's story there, it's, you know, we were, you know, being, as you said in the last segment, you know, classic sort of stories we hear over and over again. Someone says, oh no, we formatted that, you can't get the information off. It's like, well, how much do I want to? You know, you'd be surprised, you know, if I really, really want to, maybe, you know, if I have a nation state's resources and a lot of time, decades, you know, probably, we'll see.
Oh. Right. Well, in fact, certainly those discs at that time, you could do such things. And I actually ended up doing some of that, but that's a different issue. I think the thing that, you know, the baseball, right? You know, right. A baseball reformatted my discs. So, you know, people try to rip off insurance companies all the time with all sorts of bogus claims. You know, the insurance investigator's job is to fix this. Now, he wasn't an insurance investigator. He was just a guy who knew something about floppy disks. But what's more impressive is when you start moving through the different things that he did with hardware, all the controllers and the various things. When it comes to hardware, storage hardware and hardware for doing things like NTSC graphics and so forth, you know, Mark, these guys were the people that did this first. And they know, you know, intimately the minutia of how it works and why it works and everything about them, at not just at the bit level, but the electronics behind it and the analog and all that stuff. And when you're doing forensics, there's, you know, I sort of have a fundamental that says, if I'm going to work on a case, I'm going to make sure that I know everything I need to know at least one level below whatever other expert they're going to show up with. So, because I bloody well want to be right. And it's not just a matter of, you know, sort of being a perfectionist, which I guess I accidentally am, even though I really am perfect. But I mean, that's one of the characteristics of a perfectionist is they always realize, oh no, I missed it by that much. But just to get that level of knowledge, you can't have that level of knowledge unless you did those designs, unless you did those early implementations. There's no going to school. That's right. Going to educate you in the realities of turning a screw to realign a floppy drive head so that the misaligned head that wrote it on the disk aligns properly so you can now read it. And the way I learned that lesson was on a magnetic tape, which I was adjusting on a computer when I was at USC. And there's a little screw. It turns out you can sort of realign the heads. And so it turns out we ended up with a backup that was misaligned. And so, you know, you sort of, what I did was the command is cat, which is concatenate, basically type out everything on the tape. So I told it to just send out everything from the device to the display. And I watched it and I turned the screw and it started coming out to sensible. I said, okay, we're in the right place. Then I read that tape in. Okay, got that one copied into wherever I copied it to. Then I put in a tape that was done, you know, previously, like all the other tapes that wasn't misaligned. And I turned the screw back at the point where that one read okay. And that computer was doing fine with tape drives for the next, you know, year, 2 years, whatever. You know, you don't learn that by being taught that in school. You learn that by, oh, crap, how do I get this one fixed? And that's what Mark Menz and his brother Mike have, that, you know, everybody else in the disk forensics arena does not have.
Oh, yeah, there's an aspect of all of this information networking, which is what we're talking about. You know, some of it, you know, is like electrical and electronic and so on and so forth. Some of it is just human, right? And as we've understood our past better, right, one of the things I love following in my lifetime is our understanding of human past. And, you know, it turns out there was Homo sapiens for like 400 million years, and there was Homo erectus before that for 1.5 million years. And they, you know, the first group is just literally as smart as you and I, and the other group is not far short. So there's this process we've been using all along. This is exactly what we're talking about here with Mark and Mike. Nobody can know everything. Not then, not now, not ever. But we can store information in other people or in a website or a database and other things today. But as you're saying, there's no way we can have any of these things, because sometimes you got to turn to someone at the Mark level and go, oh, right. You know, I actually need to know this much. And they actually know it. And there's no way to share that information, really, because you have to be there.
Yeah, if you know them, right? Whatever you share is an incomplete recollection of the actual thing that happened, and your actual knowledge is deeper than whatever you typed in, no matter how carefully you tried to type it.
We'll be telling more stories from CyberCops in our next show, so don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, KMBY, 1240 a.m., and on the web at thecybershow.co.
You cannot get to a zero-trust architecture until you first establish trust in your network, servers, applications, and staff. Hello, I'm Michael DeSabato from TrustArch, and we're introducing a new online research and advisory service starting in November. We can help you establish a repeatable, verifiable trust architecture that will facilitate creation of policies, procedures, and guidelines that can be used to establish a secure, reliable, zero-trust environment. Our basic advisory service is available now. For full details, look for our link on the cybershow.co website, or go directly to our website at trustarch.com. That's TRUSTARCH.com in order to sign up. We look forward to working with you. Thank you, and have a lovely day.
We're having discussions with Joe Weiss. Joe is an old school control systems guy who worked on control systems for the first half of his career and ended up in cybersecurity by accident, as usual.
Joe Weiss, it's great to see you. Tell everybody, you know, your name and what you do.
Okay, my name is Joe Weiss, and I'm a control system engineer that got into cybersecurity. And so I deal with cybersecurity of control systems, which a lot of people call OT.
Yeah, OT being operational technology, right?
Correct.
So everybody knows, you know, every time you use an initial, which there are lots of, you know, ICS, yes, industrial control systems, SCADA, supervisory control and data acquisition. Every time you do that and come up with one we haven't said yet in that episode, just break it out so everybody knows what you're talking about.
Got it.
Because, you know, the lay audience here, they just don't know all this stuff. So, Joe, let's start with the beginning of your life and career, where you were born if you want, but really what we want to know is something about your education and when you first started to get interested in cyber systems and what they did. And if you want, you can tell us what your definition of a cybernetic system is.
Good. So anyways, I was born in Phoenix, ended up going to school in Arizona in nuclear engineering. And when I graduated, my first job out of school was at GE Nuclear in San Jose, which is why I'm in the area.
So hang on a second. Let's in school, nuclear engineering, presumably besides all the physics of it, which is just the physics, the engineering part is all about control systems, right?
Well, it was partially about control systems. I mean, we had analog control systems. We had digital control systems, okay? Or I shouldn't say control systems, but you had analog control and digital control.
Yeah, so yeah. Those are controls. So it can be analog. In fact, analog's a lot better for a lot of things, right?
Oh, it is. I mean, I'm just saying, and when I was going through school, the concept that I was going to be going into an area dealing with control systems wasn't really there. It was just, these were the courses I took, and then here's an elective or two I took. And it just so happens that the job that was offered to me coming out of school happened to be in the instrumentation and control systems area within GE Nuclear.
All right, so let's just talk a little bit about, in school, you know, I have an electrical engineering degree. When I was in school in electrical engineering, I had a course called controls, or control systems, something like that, with a very thick book, and it had all these equations, these feedback equations, right? So I take it you had that too, right?
I had that too, all of the things about Laplace transforms and everything else. And
Well, hang on. Now that you've said Laplace transforms, you have to explain it.
Okay. This is basically where you're converting, both time and frequency. It's a mathematical way of, if you will, trying to do, if in a sense, feedback control. If a signal comes in and you're trying to see how much error there is in the signal to correct it, you'll use things like Laplace transforms.
Okay, so now you've introduced a whole new subject area, so now we have to drill into that a little bit.
Oh, I'm going to have to keep my mouth shut.
No, you keep opening it. Look, it's a great thing.
I'm being facetious.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about this. Hang on. So when I talk about cybernetic systems or control systems, cybernetic from the book called Cybernetics by Norbert Wiener in the 1940s. Yes. Right? Yeah, all right, same book, right? So sensors, actuators, communications, and control, right?
That's what's, I'm going to deviate for a second. I just have written a micro-learning module for the International Society of Automation, and it's called Identifying Control System Cyber Incidents. And one of the first slides I have is the definition of cybernetics.
Which is?
Which is basically dealing with control of a steam turbine.
Yeah, but what are the parts of a cybernetic system then?
It's really what you're talking about in that case was the communication, between the different aspects of controlling that turbine.
So when you say controlling the turbine, you presumably have some sort of a sensor or you can't get any feedback.
You have a sensor, you have a feedback loop, you have a correction loop. The point being, the reason for bringing that up and what I just brought up is, how the term cybernetics, which is what we're talking about here, defined all the way back in the 40s or whatever, has been morphed into the term cyber, which is used today where we are talking about cybersecurity. And those terms hardly look at all similar. And if you didn't know the difference, you would never piece them together. I mean,
but Joe, to me, they look the same.
To me, right? They do, because again, I'm coming from this world of, if you will, control and communications for the control and the feedback and everything else. So to me,
sensors, actuators, communications, and control. The sensors detect the situation. The actuators change the situation. The communication between the sensors and the actuators and the control mechanism. And then the control is those feedback loops that do the Laplace transform.
Exactly. And what it does, it goes back to the sensor. The sensor sends it back. And what it's doing is you have what's called a set point. In other words, where you want to get to. So, for example, you have a pot of water that's at 80 degrees. And you want to keep the pot of water at 80 degrees. So the sensor is continuously monitoring. And it's sending this signal and it's sending it to, say a motor controlling, maybe a valve or something.
Yeah, the valve that lets more or less gas into the stove, right?
Yes. And what you're saying is if the sensor keeps telling me it's at 80 degrees and that's where I want to be, nothing happens. But if the sensor starts saying it's 81 degrees, then that signal is being sent to the actuator saying, reduce the amount of gas, say, so I can bring that 81 degrees back to 80. Or
yeah.
The flip
or
is
the 79 back up to 80.
No, 79 back. So what you're looking
right. So hang on, but Joe, so it's obviously, we know that, but that's trivial, right? So anybody can do that. You can do that with a bang-bang controller, right? You
just absolutely. Turn
it up. But that's not what we're talking about. When you're talking about analog controls or even digital controls that are better than bang-bang controllers, bang-bang means it goes one position or the other. Then we're talking about anticipating that future path. So you don't turn it up too high and turn it down too far. You turn out just the right amount so it'll adjust within the right time frame, and you avoid these feedback loops where you get positive feedback loops and the control system causes an explosion, right?
Exactly. In fact, there's a term called PID, proportional integral derivative. And that's kind of been the world of control systems. And proportional, without trying to go into all of the technical details.
We'll go into the technical details in the next segment. Let's take a break here.
Welcome, Joe.
Well, this is, you know, one of the interesting things about, you know, the time we're in OT, operational technology, right? You know, and as you guys are talking about, there are fundamentals behind this, you know, in physics and practical operations of systems to reliably produce the things that, you know, we've been producing for, you know, centuries and longer, right? And we're just now bridging that with this, you know, world where there's a working generation now who have a really hard time understanding that below the user interface and below the application and below the operating system and below the firmware, there are actual chips down there, something physical that physically does something when you apply current to it, right? So the you know, Joe and all the other folks I know in OT who've been doing this a long time, we came from that realm. You, the electrical engineers, who came from that realm, right? There's so much to learn from that for the esoteric cyber world where we think everything's going to be virtual and anyways, wave our hands around.
So you're not a big fan of drilling into the details. And Joe is about as far on the other side of the spectrum as you can ever get.
Oh, yes.
There's not going to be any macros here.
Yes.
It's all fundamental basic terms, right? And the assumption that you know what a Laplace transform is, that's just inherent in any conversation. If you don't know what that is, how can we even talk, right?
It's just, right.
And it brings me back to, I'll say, thousands and thousands of conversations I've had with engineers in my life, and having been one of them. So just listening, it's such a simple concept, right? You have the water and you're trying to boil it. And you know, if it's getting too cool, you turn up the boiler. It's just what we have in every oven in the world and every thermostat in the world is what he's talking about here. But somehow it has to be complicated and full of minutia. And by the way, of course, Joe is really good at this stuff.
Oh, yes.
So I'm not sure whether these are characteristics that are required to be really good at that stuff, but I suspect that that's the issue. If you're not like this, you can't do that.
Right. You know, from my side, you know, I embrace my own approach to it, right? You know I have to sometimes, you know, dig in the details or have them help me find somebody who is really good at the details. But, you know, the world is fractal, right? You know, any angle can be divided into more angles, any angle, you know, forever. Right. And all of these systems, whether it's, you know, building some piece of critical infrastructure, you know, we could look at the individual atoms in every section of pipeline, you know, or we had to stop at some point.
You might think so, but let's hear what Joe thinks of that, because he may not be convinced, as you will see.
Hi, I'm Jen, assisting from Trusted Cyber, your trusted cybersecurity advisors. We're introducing a new research and advisory service available live online remote starting in November. Our service focus is for company executives and senior technologists facing the emergent challenges of cybersecurity and looking for expert advisors to advise them on alternatives they might have missed, anticipate future developments, and help get handle on the path forward. You can join our basic advisory service starting now. It includes a weekly live online remote webinar with a top analysis, 4 short analysis reports per month, tickets to an executive leadership network forum once quarter, and access to our advisory network. Don't miss this outstanding opportunity for great advice from real human experts that is free of AI-generated BS and full of sound, sensible advice. For full details, look for a link on the cybershow.co or go directly to our website at trusted-cyber.com to sign up. We hope to see you there next month.
We hope you enjoyed the show, and that you will join our experts in their joint and collaborative research and advisory service offering. But before we go, I want to reassure you. While my voice is AI generated, the advice you get from our experts is not. Don't miss this outstanding opportunity for great advice from real human experts that is free of AI-generated BS and full of sound, sensible advice. Sign up for this outstanding service today at thecybershow.co.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Mark gets marked as the Federales keep calling him. Joe becomes a nuclear GE whiz. Research and Advisory starts its trek. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.